Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi folks, welcome to episode 120 of the Epochs of the Loadseaters. I am of course joined by Beau, and today we're going to be talking about one of my favourite barbarian warlords, Attila the Hun. So where do we begin with Attila the Hun?
Well, there's actually quite a lot that could be said.
Yeah.
Even though it's sort of the 5th century, which in my mind the sort of 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries are sort of the darkest of the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
However, we happen to have a fair bit on old Attila because he made such an impact that people, even people that aren't peoples that aren't particularly known for writing a great deal down, did still. And of course, there's the Romans, the actual last vestiges of the Western Roman Empire, and of course, the Byzantines. So we've got a fair bit actually. Just to mention the sources straight off the bat, Priscus is probably the main one. An Eastern Roman who actually lived through it. So he's a primary source. He actually saw Attila with his own eyeballs.
Yeah, because he was part of a deputation
by,
was it Theodorus?
It was under Theodosius.
Theodosius,
the second, that's right, So Priscus is probably, well, he's the best primary source.
I mean, he actually met Attila, didn't
he?
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get any better than that, could you?
Right, yeah, assuming what he said is true.
Why would it be?
But you've always got to add that caveat.
Yeah. We've got no particular reason to think he's lying.
But there's also a big history by Jordanes, a Historica Gothorum, which survives.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit later Sidonius, the Bishop of Clermont. And then there's other things, other histories that are lost to us but are preserved sort of indirectly. So Gregory of Tours, who lived long after, talks all about Attila and mentions other historians that are lost to us.
Right.
But we've got bits and bobs. There's Procopius is a great historian in the age of Justinian, but he wrote all about sort of the terror of Attila sweeping through the world. And there's various sort of German and Hungarian epics and poems, things all about him. The Germans know him by a different, slightly different name. So it's actually a fair bit. It's not like it's just like this shadow of a figure where we've just got a name and a bit of archaeology. We've got a fair bit of detail, really.
He's weirdly personable, right? As in, you can actually get a feel for the real man of Attila when reading something. I've read like loads about this, and I've watched documentaries. So just generally throughout my interest in history, Attila keeps popping up as just a fascinating figure. But he's a very real man in the history of it, and he's obviously a terror as well. You know, he's just a and things. I don't even know if terror is the right word, because like he obviously does awful things, and he is a terror. There's a weird sense where there's a kind of familiarity with Attila, with the Western Romans and the Goths and that. And it's not that he isn't doing awful things and causing them to, you know, have gargantuan battles and great bloodshed on either side. But he doesn't feel as, like, alien as the Mongols, right? Like, the Mongols feel like, oh, God, what is this that's turned up, you know? Attila has got a kind of weird familiarity, because he sticks around so long. Right, and he's repeatedly invading them. So, oh God, and now Attila's like, you know, come some sort of alliance with the Eastern Roman Empire and stuff like this. So there's this weird familiarity about him that means that he is not as mysterious and evil as the Mongols.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I'd agree with that, I think. Yeah, he's quite human, I suppose, in the sense that we've got loads of anecdotes of sort of snapshots of things he did. One that springs to mind that Priscus mentions is at one point he's riding through his town. I'll mention the royal village. And one of the wives of one of his senior lieutenants comes out and just offers him drink and food. and someone raises it up to him whilst he's still on horseback on sort of a silver platter, and he stops and just takes a quick glug and one quick bite just as a pleasantry.
Yeah.
But, you know, things like that. So it gives you sort of a snapshot of a real person.
Yeah.
And there's loads of those.
Yeah.
So you can see...
There's one, I can't remember which battle it was, but he's supposed to have mocked the Romans for hiding behind their shields at one point.
Mm.
It's like, so he's got, you know, he's a guy with a sense of humour. You know, he's got quips, he's got one-liners. You know, I'm the scourge of God and all this sort of stuff. It's like, okay, this is weird. You know, normally, like, there's a veil of silence between, like, you know, the Great Terror and the people suffering it. But with Attila, he talks to them, you know? He deputizes, he sends emissaries. He is actually real. So,
yeah, there's lots of sort of warlords from centuries after this where we don't really know anything about them.
Yeah.
They're sort of just a name.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be like whole generations of sort of Vandal kings and it's just really a name on a king list centuries after this. And so, yeah, we do have some nice little details of things. Like there's one, I think I'll read it, where it says he used to sort of roll his eyes in some sort of really disturbing way.
Yeah.
Little details like that. So it's actually nice that we've got a fair bit of detail. Now, I'm going to be quoting loads from Gibbon again, Edward Gibbon, in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, volume 3 in my 6-volume set. I think originally it was came out in 12 volumes, but anyway.
Right.
About halfway through The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in Gibbon. So I'm going to quote from Gibbon loads because he obviously is brilliant.
Yeah.
And he just takes all the best bits of people like Priscus and Jordanes and Procopius and whoever and just gives us the best bits. So, well, you could spend a lifetime in libraries or a lot of money getting these really, really obscure texts.
I mean,
you can just pick
Gibbon
up a second-hand version of Gibbon and it's all there for you, done already. All the work.
Because that's
done.
What Gibbon did.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, why wouldn't I just use that?
Yeah.
Okay, so... Right, so let's begin at the beginning.
All right, yeah. All right.
So my understanding of Attila is that he was some kind of Asiatic horse nomad, who ruled in a kind of triumvirate with his brothers, a people that we call the Huns, but they doubtless wouldn't have called themselves that. They probably came from like the far East Asian steppe, so they would have been Mongoloid looking in their appearance, which seems to be what people say about him, because it's hideous and bizarre, but, you know, who knows? And we don't really know, like, you know, he had an empire, but that's not an empire as we would understand an empire. I guess we'd call it like a dominion, maybe, is more appropriate. So it's just wherever the massive Hunnic army is at this point, Attila gets everything he wants, and then he goes on to wherever next, and then he gets everything he wants. And so it's hard to really, it's not an empire as we would understand it, with ranks and officialdom and a bureaucracy and defined borders and things like this. Like, it's going to be very fluid, right?
Yeah. Well, Gibbon tells us that the sort of the western portion of his quote-unquote empire, he can... or the sources, the original sources, can sort of fairly well define. And the eastern portion of it, they didn't know. So he doesn't know. So we don't know.
Yeah, because they didn't know how far the Asian steppe went.
He quite often calls him the conqueror of Scythia and Germany.
Right.
And we all know that Scythia is...
ill-defined place. Yeah, it begins in the sort of Ukrainian plains and then just... Who knows?
But it seems like he was... Mongoloid or Chinese in appearance. And I think I mentioned in the last one that quite often he'd have the Tartars, were often the vanguard of the Hunnic army.
Yeah.
And they really are from sort of Central Asia. Or even up, there's some peoples that are sort of Siberian almost. So yeah, sort of from China. And that, again, even the word China is a very loose term because, you know, in our world today, there's very, very exact borders of China. But back then, China was a lot smaller and also, again, more like just a general geographical name. People in Europe would just say China, and what they really meant was just the far, far east.
Yeah, the Orient.
Yeah. Or even that's funny, because Gibbon, you talk about Orientals, and he quite often means people from the Near East.
Well, yeah, that's a great point, actually. I was thinking sort of, you know, Victorian usage.
Yeah, but we would say Orientals. We mean Far East Asia, don't we?
Yeah, yeah. But, it,
but
yeah,
sometimes...
The border of it has continued to move eastwards,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But this is the point, isn't it, with Asia? It's a giant landmass where there aren't that many defining features in the sort of central area. So you just have no idea. And it's probably not even worth trying to figure out who's where and what's what, because it doesn't really matter. But it's
Attila, they didn't write it down, so
no. And they probably didn't even bloody know. You know? Right. Attila doesn't know the extent of his own domains. You know, he's just got like 100,000 horse mounted archers and wanders wherever he wants and kills whoever he needs to.
That's real power, isn't it? I don't even really need to know the true extent of my domains. Yeah. It's like,
what am I going to do? Send a guy over there to write down? I don't care.
There's a saying, isn't it, that if you have to check how much money you've got, then you're not rich.
Yeah,
it's like if you have to check the extent of your empire, you're not truly powerful. That sort of thing.
But there's no doubt he could raise a massive army of absolutely terrifying men. Again, the sort of men who made up the Mongol army. You know, these unbelievably hardy, pony riding, you know, recurve bow using. East, you know, Central Asians who eat raw meat and drink mare's milk and the blood of their mares to keep them going, and so can just move constantly. You know, they had like wagon trains, and so it's a very, very mobile empire, imperial. I don't know, I was going to say capital, but that's not the right word. But the you know, wherever Attila and his army is very, very mobile. So this is one of the things we see in his lifetime. He's just popping in and out of people's empires all the time.
Yeah.
And it's really, it must have been really insufferable.
Yeah. Yeah, extreme mobile. Although he does have some sort of capital, but it's not...
We don't know where it is.
We'll get to it. It's more than like a village, really. But I'll describe that because we get to that. But yeah, so just to mention the parallels with the Mongols of the 12th and 13th century, and also Timur the Lame, or Tamerlane, who's after Attila the Hun, sort of after the Golden Horde, a little bit after. What is he like, the Tamerlane? Was he the 15th century? 14th or 15th century? Who's sort of the last gasp of these truly Central Asian Mongoloid type. Mass invasion, true barbarian type people. So Attila's sort of one of the first of those, really, at least to sort of penetrate the European consciousness in a sort of proper documented way.
And just a quick thing there as well. Like, there's not like a gap between like the 5th century Attila and the 12th century Mongols. There are all sorts of other, like the Alans and the whoever else, you know, all these other, the Eastern Roman Empire has to deal with. Like these peoples are just 1,000 years of persistent headache for all of the civilized and settled peoples of Europe and China and wherever else.
Yeah. I mean, quite a few times, actually, in Gibbon, he says, we don't really know exactly how the Hun in the age of Attila did it, but here's how the Mongols did it in the 13th century.
Yeah.
Here's what Tamerlane did. So surely Attila must have operated like this.
Yeah.
So quite often he'll sort of, you think, why are we suddenly talking about Genghis Khan? And it's just because it's sort of filling in the gaps a bit.
Yeah.
But it's the same, Zingis, actually. But
it's the same style of life and the same mode of warfare. So it's probably a reasonable guess that Attila did things in basically the same way as every other steppe nomad empire throughout history.
Yeah. So to start then, his father was somebody called Munzak.
That's a nice name.
Yeah, he had a couple of brothers, but his main brother was Bleder. I think it's Bleder pronounced anyway. Right. Either way, they would have pronounced it quite, I'm sure, very differently. Yeah. And when his father died, Munzak died, he sort of, the two brothers took two portions of this giant empire. But in the end, Attila sort of, it seems, got his brother to commit suicide and took it all for himself.
So Attila probably killed his brother.
Yeah. And so where this empire stretched from somewhere in Central Asia or even East Asia, all the way through sort of the Russian steppe, I suppose, down into Hungary, pretty much, and all across sort of northern Europe, really.
Mm.
They say, we're told that at some point his dominion even stretches so far as like the Baltic,
yeah,
where he would get furs, the best furs in the world, from the Baltic coast.
Yeah, probably.
And so, yeah, where Gibbon quite often calls him the king of Scythia and Germany. Mm. And so, yeah, he had some sort of capital just north of the Danube, pretty much where Budapest is, where Buda was, and now Budapest. Probably there, around there. But we're told that there was sort of nothing made of stone. It was all just wooden.
Yeah.
So it's like one step up from just tents, true nomadic tents, but not a proper city in any real way. Apparently one of his captains commissioned some stone baths, and that was about it. Even Attila's own palace, in inverted commas, was just wood. Very ornate and fantastic. Although, then again, I suppose Charlemagne's palace, main palace, was wooden. And that's like, what, 400 years later? So,
But it does tell you a lot about the kind of people that they were. I mean, you know, you can't help but get the feeling that if Attila had to abandon his capital, he'd have just done it.
But yeah, he's not completely married to it.
No, he's not like, you know, Theodosius in Constantinople. You know, it's like, no, I have to die here. No.
There's a famous embassy, which I'll talk all about probably in quite a lot of detail, actually, from the court at Constantinople to this capital. And they just keep calling it like the royal village, they call it quite a lot. So it's like, and it's, when you went in there, all their clothes and tables were completely covered with silver and gold and jewels and things, because they've plundered everywhere. They've got loads of...
Yeah.
But they don't build in stone. So, I mean, yeah, it's interesting.
Well, they didn't make any of those things themselves, did they?
Yeah. Yeah, they're not artisans themselves.
No.
So if a very quick paragraph from Gibbon, just to sort of set out. He says this. The Western world was oppressed by the Goths and the Vandals, who fled before the Huns. But the achievements of the Huns themselves were not adequate to their power and prosperity. Their victorious hordes had spread from the Volga to the Danube, but the public force was exhausted by the discord of independent chieftains. Their valour was idly consumed in obscure and predatory excursions, and they often degraded their national dignity by condescending for the hopes of spoil to enlist under the banners of their fugitive enemies. In the reign of Attila, the Huns again became the terror of the world, and I shall now describe the character and actions of their of that formidable barbarian who alternately insulted and invaded the East and the West and urged the rapid downfall of the Roman Empire. So there's two parts really to the story of Attila when he, as I say, sort of pops up on the radar of the European world. First, sort of, perhaps obviously, is in the Eastern Roman Empire, and there's sort of that whole period, and then what happens in the West with Rome itself. And he doesn't live to be all that old. I mean, he dies in his
46, 40,
yeah, 70, yeah, right? Yeah. So he's not like he lives to be all that old. There's one story of one of the Gothic kings who, almost certainly in exaggeration, but apparently lived to be over 100.
Oh, really?
So, you know, life was a lot shorter, but you could live to be old. And anyway, he doesn't live for decades and decades and decades. Basically.
But what's remarkable about Attila is he doesn't die in battle.
No.
Considering how much of it he does, you know, it would be reasonable to expect that he would get cut down in one of the massive battles in which he engages. He dies drunk.
Well, probably we'll get to it. Yeah, we'll leave that spoiler to the end. Alert. But and he does actually get involved in combat personally.
Yeah,
not. I don't know if it's all the time, like say Alexander, but he definitely does fight on the front at least a few times. At least.
Yeah.
So yeah, throwing the dice higher, letting the chips fall where they may. When we mentioned his appearance. I've got a a fairly long paragraph here from Gibbon. So if I can read that, he says, quote, Attila, the son of Munzak, deduced his noble, perhaps his regal descent, from the ancient Huns, who had formerly contended with the monarchs of China. His features, according to the observation of a Gothic historian, bore the stamp of his national origin, and the portrait of Attila exhibits the genuine deformity of a modern Kalmuk. A large head, a swarthy complexion, small deep-seated eyes, a flat nose, and few hairs in the place of a beard, broad-shouldered, and a short square body of nervous strength, though of a disproportionate form. The haughty step and demeanour of the King of the Huns expressed the consciousness of his superiority above the rest of mankind, and he had a custom of fiercely rolling his eyes as if he wished to enjoy the terror which he inspired. See, little details like that, you can sort of imagine it, can't you? I think that's a great little detail there. Yet this savage hero was not inaccessible to pity. His suppliant enemies might confide in the assurance of peace or pardon, and Attila was considered by his subject as a just and indulgent master. So that's something to mention, isn't it? He doesn't seem to be a completely insane sadist.
Yeah.
He's barbaric, but he's... And we'll just order whole cities of menfolk executed and all the women
enslaved
and or raped and all that sort of thing. But in a one-on-one, he's not,
that's,
you know,
just funny to think about. Like, what a strange contradiction, right?
Yeah. But you can trust his word. If he says, oh, you're, say, an emissary from a foreign king and come into my court, you won't be just murdered. Let you go afterwards. You can trust him on that.
Yeah, which is more than you could with a lot of the Mongols and things like this.
Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting about Attila is he clearly has a code of honour. Like, it's a really barbaric one, right?
That's right. Yeah,
and it's totally uncivilized. But in his own paradigm, he seems to have been really well liked by his own people. And he seems to have actually governed, if that's the right word, in a way that they found amenable. And so it's like, okay, you know, like, you know, I don't like the things that he did or the person that he was or any of those things. But this is the thing, he's not psychotic, right? He's obviously for a given value of psychotic, but yeah, like you say, he's not mad, right? He's not some sort of raving madman who just, you know, has bloodlust or something. You know, he's actually weirdly, I don't know, someone you could deal with.
Just about, yeah. There's a lot of people in history I would trust a lot less than Attila.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, for example, this brings to mind, there's the Vandal king Genseric, which I'll probably mention at some point in this story.
Almost any of them, to be honest.
Yeah. Someone like Stalin.
Yeah.
Someone like Napoleon, even. Do not trust anything he says ever. He'll go back on anything he's promised you in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
Well,
there are loads of Roman emperors. Just I wouldn't want to be near, because they might get it in their heads that they want to hurt me in some way. But like you say, actually, Attila doesn't seem like that kind of madman.
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting. Like, he seems confident in his own power, you know?
Yeah.
So
I would trust Attila's word over someone like Caligula or Nero,
for example.
So
I would expect Attila not to torture me.
Yeah.
He doesn't. I mean,
at least after he's promised not to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, if he said he's not going to, you know, not going to hurt me, I'd expect not to get hurt. I mean, yeah, he may well torture me if he thinks I've got some information he wants or something. But
so we've sort of said there on some level.
At least I
level,
know it was coming, you know.
We've said there on some level he's sort of trustworthy or not the worst.
He's a total barbarian.
Yeah.
He's a total barbarian. So, and he enjoys being the barbarian as well, you can tell. You know,
like, lays waste, just leaves cities in ash.
Oh, yeah.
Just bodies, bones littering the highways in his wake.
But he also seems to recognise the civilised nature of the Romans and revels in being the opposite of that, right? As in, we live a different life to you, and we know that we live a different life to you.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. He just considers, at some point I was reading, he just considers the Roman Christians as just one of the many peoples in the world.
Yeah.
They're not, there's nothing particularly special about them.
No.
I don't have to particularly care what the bishops, the Christian bishops say, or the emperor in Constantinople or Rome.
Mm.
I won't give them any more credence or respect than any other king or so-called emperor that I've come across. That's how he sees it.
Yeah.
You can sort of imagine why. If his domains, his empire is world-spanning, really.
From his perspective.
Yeah. So Gibbon goes on to give a flavour of it. He delighted in war, but after he had ascended the throne in a mature age, his head rather than his hand achieved the conquest of the north, meaning basically Germany and Europe, really. And the fame of an adventurous soldier was usually exchanged for that of a prudent and successful general. The effects of personal valour are so inconsiderable, except in poetry and romance, that victory, even among the barbarians, must depend on the degree of skill to which the passions of the multitude are combined and guided by the service of a single man. The Scythian conquerors, Attila and Genghis, surpassed their rude countrymen in art rather than in courage, and it may be observed that the monarchies, both of the Huns and of the Mongols, were erected by their founders on the basis of popular superstition. Hmm. I'm going to go on to tell this story here, which is obviously just a story. But I've picked it out because I think it sort of, yeah, it tells you something about what they thought about themselves, if nothing else.
Yeah.
So there was a popular superstition around, because again, it's already here mentioned the Mongols. There's this idea that that Genghis was sort of picked by the heavens to conquer the world.
Yeah.
So Attila's got something like that going on himself.
Hmm.
Gibbon says, the miraculous conception which fraud and credulity ascribed to the Virgin Mother of Genghis raised him above the level of human nature, and the naked prophet who in the name of the deity invested him with the empire of the earth pointed the valour of the Mongols with irresistible enthusiasm. The religious arts of Attila were not less skilfully adopted to the character of his age and country. It was natural enough that the Scythian should adore with peculiar devotion the god of war, but as they were incapable of forming either an abstract idea or a corporal representation, they worshipped their tutelar deity under the symbol of an iron scimitar. One of the shepherds of the Huns perceived that a heifer who was grazing had wounded herself in the foot and curiously followed the track of the blood, till he discovered, among the long grass, the point of an ancient sword, which he dug out of the ground and presented to Attila. That magnanimous, or rather that artful prince, accepted with pious gratitude this celestial favour. And as the righteous possessor of the sword of Mars asserted his divine and indefensible claim to the dominion of the earth.
I love this kind of barbarian myth-making.
Yeah.
Like, cow stood on a sword in the ground. It must be a sign from the heavens.
Dig it out. That's the sword of Mars, is it?
Oh, it is now.
And it means you're destined to rule the world. Oh, does it?
Great point.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, if you exactly. Say so. I mean, how could I contest that?
If you say so. Like, right?
But what I love this sort of stuff. It's just like these are the sort of like...
I like that story.
Insane mythology that you can't really contest. And so it just becomes like cemented, you know, written in the stars. It's like, okay, yeah, good point.
Yeah. I like that.
So
there's this whole period where he sort of comes crashing down out of the steppe.
Yeah.
And in fact, he fights many battles with, the Persians and the Medes. Mm. Gibbon says that still the Persians and the Medes sort of in what would be, Iran, northern Iraq. Even into
Afghanistan.
I was going to say even into sort of where modern day Georgia is, and sort of northeast Turkey, sort of the Caucasus, where the Caspian Sea is, all around there. He's fighting all around there before, and the Eastern Roman Empire, or all of Europe really, just hear of all this. They're aware of it, but it hasn't touched them yet.
Yeah.
and they're aware of it. And in fact, the Medes, so-called, defeat him at a big battle. Obviously don't defeat him entirely, but force him out of their lands.
Yeah. Is this the Sasanian Empire or something?
Yeah.
So it's some...
The sons of Sasan.
Yeah, there's some successor Persian Empire, basically.
Yeah.
Who view themselves as the Persians, you know. They consider themselves the inheritors of this lineage. So that's, you know, it's interesting. But yeah, it's interesting that he's essentially just looking for an easy win, right? Mm. He's just looking around, where can I plunder? Yeah, I'm literally just a roving barbarian warlord. I'll try these guys. Oh, they were a bit tough. I'll go for these next guys. Oh, they bought me off. I'll go for these guys. These were kind of weak. I'll punch them.
Mm.
It's just literally that simple. It's like playground bully.
Yeah.
You know.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.